Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
He kōna e ipurangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
He wasn't your classic suave, sharp dressing con man. But in some ways, he's arguably New Zealand's greatest liar.
Welcome to Crimes NZ, a podcast where we revisit some of New Zealand's most notorious crimes with people who got close to the cases. Today's crime involves David Ross, the man behind New Zealand's largest Ponzi scheme. It was a scam that saw thousands of New Zealand investors lose millions of dollars. And here to tell us about it is former New Zealand Herald Wellington business editor Hamish Rutherford.
We got a call in the newsroom about some troubles at a money manager on the terrace that the Financial Markets Authority had raided, and we turned up and the office was locked. Some people who worked in the office next door said there's definitely some trouble here, and then over the next sort of 2 or 3 weeks it unfolded that an extremely low profile person who purported to be managing hundreds of millions of dollars for individuals and families, that it was all just a fiction.
Now, probably a good time to talk about what a Ponzi scheme is, Hamish, because we'll be referring to it throughout. Can you explain it for us, please?
Well, in simple terms, a Ponzi scheme is a fraud where returns are paid to existing customers by bringing new money in from new customers. They tend to have very strong returns. They're also characterised by the fact that it's a fiction. And as more and more people are attracted, the fund just gets further and further behind because they need to keep attracting more and more money to cover the expectations of existing customers, some of which are leaving. And eventually it collapses on itself. It was founded by a guy by the name of Charles Ponzi back in the 1920s. But actually the type of fraud has been happening since before then, and certainly has happened many, many times since. But that's the characterisation, that people think they're getting very good returns. It attracts new people in, but eventually the capital that people have been putting in just sort of slowly eats itself until it catches up on the perpetrator.
How does the con man or con woman think it's going to end? It seems like it will only ever last for a little while.
Well, indeed. No one quite knows what happened in the case of Ross Asset Management, but his official story was that he made a mistake with client money and he tried to make it back. So you just sort of, you make a mistake or you start with a little lie. You say that investors generated 5% return in a certain period when they'd lost 5%, and you think you can get out of it. What it often ends up happening is perpetrators take riskier and riskier bets to try and make up the losses, but eventually it does collapse. And indeed, they often collapse quite quickly.
So who is David Ross?
So David Ross, for one thing, he's never really spoken publicly. We know that he grew up in Otago. He went to Waitaki Boys High School, which by coincidence is the same high school I went to.
Right.
He studied at Otago University and eventually moved to Wellington sometime in the 1970s. And Wellington really was the sort of the financial hub of New Zealand at the time. All the banks were based down here. I believe he worked at ANZ for a while. Mm-hmm. He rose to prominence at a firm called Leadenhall, which were quite an aggressive manager of money in the 1980s in New Zealand. They famously ran the pensions for the staff at Briley Investments. That company got into quite a lot of trouble in the share market crash in 87. Ross set up on his own in 1989, and that's when he started Ross Asset Management. And he slowly built up a business managing money for what you might call generally wealthy individuals and families. He wasn't your classic con man. He always had a bit of a speech impediment. Some of the people who knew him said he was a slightly shabby dresser, especially considering the what you'd expect from people in the finance industry.
Maybe that was reassuring.
Well, somewhat.
He wasn't too flashy.
Yeah, well, and he lived a lifestyle that you wouldn't say was exactly flashy, but was hardly, he drove a BMW. He certainly had a huge house out in Lower Hutt that, even back in 2012, I think was valued at about $2 million. So it's not like he didn't live a life that you'd expect from a successful money manager, but he wasn't your classic suave, sharp dressing con man. He was quite unassuming. He really disliked public speaking and so on because of his speech, apparently. But in some ways, he's arguably New Zealand's greatest liar. I mean, the whole time, the people who he's managing money for often became his friends. He was going to their birthday parties. He was having them to his birthday party, presumably all the time knowing that it was all going wrong. When you think about the sort of, the mental strength it would take to just maintain that sort of life so long.
Yeah, well, the lack of shame.
Mm.
Was this a pretty classic Ponzi scheme he was running?
Yes. I mean, he was telling people that he was buying and selling shares, and he was providing monthly or quarterly reports to people, and you'd get a printout and you'd say you had this amount of shares in one company and that amount of shares in another company, and returns went up and down, so people tended to believe it. According to certainly what I heard him say once at the parole board, it was a legitimate company until about 2006, although the liquidators, I spoke to about it later, and they said no, it was probably a fraud lease back until about 2000. That was certainly the event that he pleaded guilty to in court. And yeah, by the end he was providing elaborate reports to all his clients about what they apparently owned, and almost none of it was true. I mean, so we don't know exactly who the customers were. There was something in the order of about 1,700 accounts that he had, or 900 investors, but some of those would have been for individuals, some of them would have been for families. They were predominantly from the Lower North Island. Ross was based in Wellington. It seemed that there were a fair number of what you call successful lawyers and public servants and so on, quite a lot of retired farmers. They were spread across the country. There were what the liquidators have told me were, quote-unquote, sophisticated investors, people who are sort of professional investors that had some money placed there, and they arguably should have known better. But the defining characteristic was that everyone was a friend of a friend of a friend. People were almost invited to be part of this, and they would think that they were having a very successful time, and so they would tell their friends about it, and those people would tell their friends about it. There wasn't a website, and, I mean, you imagine the guilt that after this collapse this would lead to, because, you lost money in it, your friend recommended you went in, you recommended to your friends who have also lost money in it. So it was a lesson about, trusting word of mouth recommendations.
How many investors were there?
I believe it was in the order of 900, but, again, the number of people that are affected by that, because it could be, the elderly grandparents of a large family, although people don't necessarily like to talk about it, there would be families that were expecting to inherit that money and so on. Yeah. So when you think about the number of people who are affected by it, it could be, I would believe, in the thousands, because, these were predominantly older people, and among their families there would have been an expectation to inherit that money, and it was, and to a large part it was also gone. The other sort of complicating and very uncomfortable part about this is that, a chunk of people did get their money out, and in fact got the profit out, the fictional profit that wasn't real, which was arguably inadvertently stolen from other people. And so I know for a fact that it created some real divisions and ended friendships and so on.
One of New Zealand's biggest frauds?
That's my understanding. And in terms of a fraud considered undertaken by an individual, yes, the largest. And he was charged with, $115 million in losses, but the clients thought that he was managing more like $450 million. So, for example, if you, you sold your farm and you had $1 million and you gave it to Ross Asset Management a decade earlier, over time, if you were getting sort of between 10 and 20% of the year, that money would more than double. And yes, you could say that person lost $1 million, but they had the expectation that they had sometimes had millions of dollars in there. There are examples of parents who gave out money to their children to go into houses, to buy houses and so on, and then discovered that they had no money and had to then borrow money back off their children.
I was just looking at your notes of how long this went on for. I assumed it was for a few years in the early 21st century, but it started when?
Well, the company started in 1989, and Ross's account of it was that for the majority of time it was a legitimate business that went wrong. He tried to trade his way out of it, went to the lawyers a couple of times, thought about going to police, but just didn't. The account that went to court was that it was a fraud back until at least 2000. And that's sort of what characterised, often as you sort of said before, these things can collapse quite quickly. But this went on for longer than most frauds of its type do.
And how did it all end for him?
It ended when people couldn't get their money back. There were people who were trying to contact Ross saying they wanted their money, and they simply couldn't get hold of him. I think it was in about October 2012. Some investors approached the Financial Markets Authority and said, we can't get hold of Ross. And eventually they raided his office and found, well, I don't know precisely what, but there was in a certainly not the kind of state that you would expect a fund manager of its type to be. David Ross was given compulsory treatment under the Mental Health Act, and but very quickly cooperated with authorities, and within about 2 weeks, the receivers then, PwC, put out a report saying that it was probably all a fiction.
And what were the charges?
The charges brought by the SFO were false accounting and theft by person in a special relationship. These were representative charges. I mean, clearly he had defrauded hundreds and hundreds of people, but he was in agreement to plead guilty. There was also charges brought by the Financial Markets Authority providing a financial service that he wasn't registered to provide, making false statements to the Financial Markets Authority. But it was he agreed to plead guilty to a very serious fraud.
All right. And was sentenced to how long?
10 years and 10 months, and with a non-parole period of about 5 years, I believe.
I've got some audio, some RNZ audio from Checkpoint on November 15th, 2013, and this is Judge Dennis Barry addressing Ross at the sentencing.
You stole from the people who trusted you with their life savings. You constructed an enormous web of increasingly complex deceit to maintain this illusion that you were a skilled and trusted advisor and benefactor. The cold, hard reality is that you were a liar and a thief.
Yeah, strong language. And here's the spokesperson for the Ross Asset Management Investors Group, Bruce Tichpond, speaking outside court that same day.
David Ross is dead meat. He's gone. Today was very important for people to be able to express themselves emotionally, very, very important. I mean, I was nearly in tears myself. I found that very, very difficult to listen to, how hurt and devastated those people are.
That's a big story here, of course, Hamish, is the impact on the victims.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you might say, you know, no one was killed in this, but for hundreds of people who expected to have financial security, it was taken away. I was listening to that segment from Checkpoint last night. There was one couple who had raised more than $500,000, or thought they had, for a house for their severely autistic son. That's all gone. And so for many, many people, this was utterly devastating for them. And I think underlying all of it is, you know, a sense of embarrassment because every single one of them was conned.
And so how do we go about appraising the sentence, working out whether it's too harsh or too soft or about right?
Well, I mean, I'm really not sure. I mean, he was released after about 6 or 6.5 years. There's certainly still a huge degree of residual bitterness among some of his former investors. Is it long enough? I mean, it was 6 years in Rimutaka prison, so it's not exactly a light sentence. I know a lot of white-collar criminals often get very light sentences. This was a fairly serious one, but this was an enormous crime that affected, you know, many, many hundreds and possibly thousands of people.
There are some other rules as well that came with his sentence?
And well, several. He certainly isn't allowed to contact any of his former investors. That for some, that's a bit galling, because I think I don't know what each individual investor wants, but I think some probably would want to hear from him, might want to stand up and shout at him. I mean, I guess they got some of them got a chance to do that at the sentencing, but so he. After leaving, after giving his account to the parole board, he's been able to sort of disappear off to obscurity.
Mm. He did appeal the sentence.
He did, on the grounds that it was manifestly excessive, although the Court of Appeal dismissed it.
Okay, and he applied, as you say, to the parole board. I think it was his third hearing before he was eventually paroled.
Yes, it was. I didn't cover that. I was at the second of the two parole hearings, and he gave this account that it had been a legitimate business until about 2006. The parole board felt he didn't show proper remorse. He was certainly fixated on the idea that investors were going to try and sue him when he got out. A few months later, he had a third hearing. According to the parole board, he did show genuine remorse, and they released him.
Paroled to a secret location. Don't hear that phrase very often.
Well, indeed. I mean, you know, there will be a quite a lot of very bitter former investors, and who he will probably not want to bump into, and it doesn't appear. I mean, I'm sure there's certain people who know where he is, but it doesn't appear as though investors have found out where he is.
Did investors ever get any money back?
They did, about 20 cents in the dollars. These were the investors that lost money. So there was some money when the company collapsed. There was some. There was about $10 million worth of investments. But as I said earlier, there was also a group of investors who got out with more than their original investment. Some of them got their money out completely. In the sort of 5 or 6 years following the collapse, there was a number of legal cases to try and claw back money from different people. And the threat of court was often enough to get people to settle. There was a very lengthy court process against a Wellington lawyer. Went all the way to the Supreme Court. He eventually had to give back his the profit that he made of it. I think all up they managed to claw back about $20 million from people who had quote-unquote profited from the scheme, and that was shared out eventually, I think, in 2018 or 2019, but about 20 cents in the dollar, and of the original investment. So again, if you put in $200,000 at the start, a few years later, you thought you had $500,000. You're getting 20% of your original investment. So for most people, it seemed like a tiny, tiny fraction of what they put in, and so much later.
Would you be surprised to hear someone who said that a lot of her parents' friends sold their farms and invested all the money into Ross assets?
I think there were stories that a lot of farmers from Manawatu and Wairarapa that did do exactly that. And, you know, if your friend had done that and was getting a good experience, getting good returns, then you were encouraged to do that. I mean, even if I'm getting an electrician, I like to know that one of my friends has had the service from that person. So it is a real reminder that you shouldn't just trust what your friends tell you, because I think, you know, your friends were in the scheme. You thought that it must be legitimate.
Yeah. Has the law changed at all to protect investors from these sorts of schemes?
Not really. There was the Financial Markets Authority has tightened up some of the rules around financial advisors, around the disclosures that they have to make, around the rules, the hurdles they have to jump through. The law around Ponzi schemes hasn't changed. There was a proposal. There have been some very minor changes, but in the way that that would affect unwinding a Ponzi scheme, it hasn't. It was proposed to, and Chris Farfoy shelved it. This is a fairly small. These frauds are happening all the time, but there aren't that many of them. I would say that in the US they have quite a different philosophy. The Bernie Madoff fraud that was uncovered in 2008, and I believe is the largest of its type ever, they're still clawing back money now, 12 years later, and their philosophy is, in simple terms, to just claw back every cent. So if you even got your original sum of money out, they claw it all back and then wait to return the money later. Whereas in New Zealand, there's a, you know, they can only reverse transactions that were 2 years before a company's collapse, and the courts found that people could keep their original capital. So that was part of the reason why investors only got those who lost only got such a small proportion of their money back.
Well, thanks for listening to Crimes NZ, hosted by me, Jesse Mulligan. You can catch more of me each afternoon from 1 to 4 on RNZ National. We've got an upbeat mix of mostly New Zealand stories, including some you can catch as a podcast, like Our Changing World, our science series, or Voices, which tells the personal stories of people from all over the world who now call Aotearoa home. You can find all RNZ's podcasts on the website, rnz.co.nz, and they're on Apple, Spotify, iHeart, or wherever you catch your favourite podcasts.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.